Hello everybody, welcome to this Equality North Somerset event. I know you haven't come here to listen to me talk, so I will not take very long at all. Just wanted to sort of remind people before Danny talks that some areas in North Somerset are in the most affluent 1% of areas wards in England, and some of our areas are in the poorest, most deprived wards. Men in our most affluent communities can live on average 10 years longer than men in our less, in our poorest areas. And I think, you know, people have been talking about this for a long time, and I think we all care deeply, and I think our councillors do, and the council does, but still, it seems to be sort of continuing. It doesn't seem to be getting any better. In fact, it's getting relatively worse. So when I moved to North Somerset 15 years ago, we were 7th most unequal district in England, and now we're the 3rd, so relatively we're actually getting worse. So a group of us started to talk about what can we do differently, can we do, you know, is there anything that you can do, is it just hopeless? So we started to try and educate ourselves, and we joined the Equality Trust, and we formed an affiliated group, which is Equality North Somerset. And we decided to educate ourselves and others and raise awareness of inequality. So since we formed a couple of years ago, we've had a talk by the economist Stuart Mansley, which is where you well attended. We had a screening of The Divide at the Curzon in Clevedon. We had a poverty hearing this summer, which was hosted by the Bishop of Taunton. And then a little group of us went to see Professor Danny Dorling talk at Bristol University in June, I think, is it? Yeah. Something like earlier in the year anyway, and we were audacious enough to ask him afterwards if he'd mind coming to Weston-super-Mare to talk to us, and I was sceptical whether this would happen, but I always admire my colleagues and friends for their optimism, and I was really pleased and delighted to be proven wrong when Professor Dorling kindly agreed to come, so we were absolutely really pleased about that. Just a little housekeeping, I just wanted to say that we will probably be taking some, we'll be taking some photographs, which we'd like to sort of use for publicity, so if anybody would prefer not to be in any photos, then please do let me know. Okay. So, and then at the end, tomorrow or in the next couple of days, I will email people with the slides from this presentation, and I will also ask your permission to put you on my mailing list for Equality North Somerset, which is no big commitment. I obviously won't be inundating you with emails, because I don't really have time to do that. But if you don't come back to me and say you agree, then that's absolutely fine. You won't hear any more. But if you do, you know, I'm hoping that people will be inspired and want to join us and get more involved. So thank you very much for turning out this dark and sort of grim evening, and thank you even more to Danny Dorling for coming along.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It's a very good direct train from Reading, I've got to say. And you shouldn't be shocked when people come, they're a part of the country. It's been very hard to get to. I'm only going to speak for about 40 minutes at most. We've got loads and loads of time for questions. So if you get annoyed, you can always shout up and say you want to ask a question, but don't worry, there's enough time to ask. I don't know how you're finding Brexit. I'm loving it. I don't know. I'm finding it particularly enjoyable because I'm easily bored. And often politics is very, very boring. But when you've got no idea what's going to happen, it is at least exciting. How many people have bought a few extra tins of soup at home? Just any idea? Just a little bit of hoarding? You're not going to admit, are you, to it? Might be worth it because inflation, you know, will go up. The other thing I should say before I get going is I'm trying not to be flippant or condescending about things, but it gets very dull if I give a very dull talk for 40 minutes. So I do try and look on the bright side of things. I know what's going on is very serious. It's very, very geographical. Brexit, it turns out, although we didn't realise at the time, is all about borders. They really do matter. And we also have a Prime Minister who is a geographer, our first Prime Minister who's a geographer. So if you're a geographer, this thing is fascinating. I'm going to tie in inequality, but I can't prove that inequality is really important. It's just a supposition. The only thing I'm going to be able to prove to you tonight is about where people voted. And what's remarkable about where people voted is that the press and many analysts have got it completely wrong. When they tell you that this is a vote from the left behind working class northerners of Britain, it is easy to know that that is wrong, because we know how many people voted Leave in each area, how many voted Remain, and how many didn't vote. And in short, this was a southern out vote. The majority of the Leave votes are in the south of England. And if you're going to remember anything, that simple, uncontestable fact is extremely important. When you hear Boris and Jacob Rees-Mogg talking up for the working class northerners that they think they represent, you have to remember that it doesn't matter how people voted in Sunderland or in Stoke or in Middlesbrough. The numbers were too small, it didn't make a difference. What mattered was Hampshire and Kent and Wiltshire and here and Dorset and the home counties. So that's the only thing I'm sure of. Everything else you're going to get is supposition. For the last couple of years, with my colleague Sally Tomlinson, I've been writing a book about Brexit and what it means and what we think it tells us about the English, because it wasn't expected. And it wasn't just that the result wasn't expected, but the actual studies of the results that have come afterwards have been conflicting. Lots of people have produced survey results and regression analysis and other things telling you why it happened and what it means. And the most interesting thing about them is they all differ from each other. So they can't all be right. Somebody probably has it right. Of course, I think I've got it right, but you know, I'm old enough to know there's a very good chance I haven't. But again, what you can be sure of, given how many stories are being told and how different they are, is that most of them have to be wrong. So we're still in the middle of this. We're still trying to understand what's going on. It's a little bit like after the Watts riots in LA in the 1960s. The immediate analysis of the riots was, this is terrible, these are criminals, it's awful what's happened, and they're just badly behaved. It was only 3 years after the riots when Martin Luther King said, what you're actually seeing is the voice of the unheard, that people began to say, these riots are actually telling us something else about the United States. I don't happen to think that Brexit is the voice of the unheard. I happen to think it's the voice of the disgruntled elderly Tory voting electorate, who were the majority of the voters. But it's still a very, very powerful voice. I've only got 11 slides to go, you'll be glad to know. I'm very proud of this. One of my students is sitting there and she knows how many slides I can do. It's taken me a year to get this down to 12 slides, so please don't complain about the number of graphs, it's difficult to get it down. Let's start off with inequality. There has to be a reason why of all the 28 member states of the EU, we are the first, possibly the last for some time, to try to leave. Right? There has to be a reason. Now, there's only one country which left the European Community before. And that was a country very far, far away. It was Greenland. And in Greenland, because they have 56,000 people, they spent 3 years negotiating their deal. And they got quite a good deal. We're still sending €500 per child per year to Greenland to help them educate the children. Because they can get Danish citizenship, they're actually still coming to the EU. So how did Greenland get a good deal, apart from giving themselves 3 years? Essentially, and this is the first of my trite comments, but they had fish. They had a lot of fish. And one of the things that we're discovering, that we'll discover particularly in the next few weeks, is what have we got? What are we worth? Why might not we be worth quite as much as we thought we were worth? They can't do without us, we buy their cars and so on, they need our banks. If that turns out to be the case, how did we get the attitude that says that we are so very important? But let's start off with inequality. We are remarkably unusual. What you're seeing here, the top graph, is a trend over time. The red line is the take of the best off 10th of people. The best of 10 for people in Britain now take 40% of everything each year, leaving 60% to everybody else. 90% of people are living on 60% of the average, which is not very much. This is the greatest income inequality in the whole of the EU. And it's quite hard when you're a large country, the large countries are France, Germany, Italy, Spain and us, to actually end up at the top of a league table as a large country really takes some effort. But we have managed to become the most unequal country in Europe. We don't do badly on the world league table of inequality. The graph at the bottom is just the top of a very much larger graph, which is all OECD countries. And it's, if you like, it's the kind of top end of shame, because the bulk of this graph is full of countries like France and Germany and Japan and Korea and so on, which have normal, very low levels of inequality. We're at the top end. It's the Gini coefficient that's being shown, if you've got good eyesight. Mexico, 0.46, is near the 0.5. If you want to know what 0.5 means for a Gini coefficient, I'm going to explain it to you now. If you didn't want to know, I'm afraid I'm still going to explain it. If you're going to become more unequal and get to 0.5, imagine that all of you had a household income. That's not your own income, it's your total household income, you and your significant other, maybe a kid who's working, £25,000 a year. And you lot, actually not all of you, because there's a bit more of you, but you're on £75,000 a year. Now, imagine what you can do with an income of £75,000 a year, and imagine what you can do with an income of £25,000 a year. That's what a country like Mexico is like. That's the kind of differences. You don't worry about money for food. You're worrying about the third or fourth holiday you're going to take. You're not going to have a holiday. You're balancing a holiday versus a cleaner. You're the cleaner for them. That's the kind of differences. Now, in many parts of Britain, we actually are approaching that kind of inequality. And it's really, really unusual. If you go through the league table, Mexico and Chile are the most unequal of the OECD countries. Chile is the only country in the OECD, this is a club of rich countries in the world, Chile is the only country that spends more on private education than we do. People in Britain don't tend to know there is essentially no private education on the mainland. Hardly any. There are some schools for very slow boys that are expensive. But that really is what it's like. We also don't tend to know that on the mainland you tend to either pay nothing or a tiny fee to go to university. We also don't know that our children can go and study in Germany for free. Even after Brexit you can go and study in Germany for free. But Germany takes students from all over the planet for free. They take 330,000 a year, more than we do. There are lots and lots of things we don't know. We have not known them, because if we knew all this stuff, we'd get a bit annoyed. Because we're told it isn't possible. Oh no, you have to charge the universities. How could you possibly deliver it for free? That'd be like delivering a health service for free. You can't do that. And that's to come. So just going through the league tables, and it's interesting to think about the politics of these countries. Turkey is the third. And if you know anything about the politics of Turkey at the moment, you'll know there are enormous pictures of the president in Istanbul. I mean, it's not quite 1930s Germany, but it's not far off it in Turkey at the moment. Fourth is the United States. Now, they don't yet have enormous pictures of Trump everywhere, but the United States is not doing well politically. Then you've got Lithuania. The Baltic states are always interesting, and if anybody's particularly nerdy, we can talk about the Baltic states later. They had a particular issue with equality, but particularly with Russians, anyway. And these things are always nuanced. And then after Lithuania, there's Russia, which is a very, very unequal country. Russia, actually, in a remarkably short amount of time, I think it's 12 years from 1989, managed to achieve the inequality that we built up since 1066. So if you wonder why all those Russians are coming to London and buying property, it's partly because people are angry back in Russia, and they feel a bit safer in London. But Russia's a very unequal country. And almost as unequal as us. We're almost as unequal as Russia. And just to sort of, I don't know, try and drive it home, we are slightly more unequal by income than Israel. And that's Israel including the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. And if you think about how people get on with each other in Israel, and what they think of each other, and the lack of respect and so on, the fact that we actually are slightly worse than Israel, I think is quite stunning. But, you know, we don't have guns, we're not shooting people, there are not big fences up. It's all done in a very subtle English way. It's remarkable how we had a brief period of equality in the 40s, 50s, 60s and 70s. The 1970s, when I grew up, was the most equal period in the history of this country ever. But before then, we were a very hierarchical state, almost feudal. And we've kind of rapidly headed back to that at the moment. And it may be that huge, huge increase in inequality that has actually helped to drive the dissatisfaction that has led to the situation that we're currently in. But it's very hard to prove it. That's falling at the moment. We passed peak inequality around about 2014. The last time we had peak inequality was around about 1913. Think about that, 1913. Things aren't necessarily good after the peak of inequality. The normal way in which you become more equal is you take part in a war. Losing a war is by far the best way to become more equal. Because when you lose a war, the elite are replaced. The people who are in charge are no longer allowed to be in charge in Germany or Japan. But actually winning a war that takes a long time is a good way to become more equal. The First World War was supposed to last a matter of weeks. It went on for years, it cost a lot of money, the money could only be raised by from the rich. Taxes increased dramatically to do that, and that's the last time. If you're being depressed about Brexit, compared to a war, it is almost an infinitely better way to become more equal. What else could have resulted in the governor of the Bank of England telling people, was it last week, I forget, house prices might fall by 30% within 5 months? I don't know if any of you are trying to sell a house at the moment. I would basically wait to do that. And of course, if you look at wealth inequality, the bulk of wealth inequality in Britain is the difference between those who own a house and those who don't. If the value of British housing were to fall by 30%, that actually is the most rapid increase in wealth equality you can get. People aren't going to be very happy about it. But it's going to be interesting what the effect of Brexit is going to be on the inequality statistics. Because inequality is very, very expensive. It's very hard to actually give 40% of your income every year to 10% of the people. It costs money to be unequal, it's not efficient. So that's just setting the scene for our inequality. But I want to set another scene that I can't help think really, really matters. Again, when you come back to why Britain? Why of all the countries of Europe, was it the country that had a special deal that wasn't paying into the EU what everybody else has to pay in? You know, we were paying less than we should. Why was it the country that was getting these millions of young, highly educated, fit people coming here that we hadn't paid for their schooling or university? And we were sending roughly a million of our old to die on the mainland. Nick takes that. David Cameron's that. They both died in France. Looking at it objectively, it was an incredible deal we had. Nowhere else in Europe had an opt-out where they didn't pay what they should have paid. And, like the Pied Piper of Hamelin, got the young to come and do really badly paid jobs really well. And stuff them into housing at the highest density and make them pay enormous rents. And we could all go there and die. And their health service would have to look after us. You know, what? You've got to step back and think, what, you know, all the places that might have left, you'd have thought it'd be somewhere that was actually losing out, rather than somewhere which was benefiting. That map's a map of the British Empire. It's an unusual map. I like drawing maps in which everybody gets the same amount of space. So India's big. You might look at that and go, well, that's an opportunity. Think what they're going to buy from us in future. And what you need to do, if you're thinking that, is you need to know that currently we buy about £9 billion worth of stuff from India every year, not very much. But they only buy £6 billion from us. Because what have we got that they want to buy? Anyway, we'll get to that later. The dates, if you're interested, are when... That's why I put this. I don't know how many of you were taught at school about the empire. The dates are the dates when the country came forward to Queen Victoria and said, please, can we be part of your empire? None of us were taught, were we, at school, how this thing happened. Yeah. The clue is they didn't come and ask you part of the empire. The country that kind of should be there on the edge is China. China was never part of the empire. But China was the country, I think, most affected by the British Empire. Every Chinese school child is taught this. That the British turned up with gunships because they'd grown an awful amount of opium in India and they had to sell it. And so we used our bullets to inflict opiates on the Chinese and destroy their civilization. They're told that because it's true. We're not told it because it's deeply, deeply embarrassing. The whole thing is deeply embarrassing. The fact that we destroyed the textile industry in India, so we had a market for cotton that was worked in Manchester, that was picked by slaves in America, who were taken from Africa in a trade that we largely built. We talk endlessly about how we ended the slave trade. I won't go on about it, but there comes a time when you've actually got to face up to what you were about and involved in, the world's biggest empire. And our attitude to the world's biggest empire is, well, we bought railways, and we bought civilization, and oh, it was a white man's burden, and we didn't benefit. That is our attitude. We didn't benefit. So when India went, and when the last colonies in Africa went, and when suddenly we looked to be doing very, very badly economically, just coincidentally at the same time as we lost our empire, right? Oh, it's the trade unions. Also socialists or whatever else it was. I mean, honestly, you know, no, people stopped buying our ships. Why did they stop buying our ships? Had the shipyard silted up and you couldn't... Because they had to buy our ships before, because it was our empire. What we're told, what I was told at school, apart from being taught in A-level geography where to go to form a colony, I was literally taught where rubber and tin and iron comes from and how to get it and how to control the city and also how rivers work in case there was a big river in the territory I was going to be a colonial officer of and volcanoes, because you never know what might happen. That's geography. What we were taught in school in our history was that we invented everything. The Industrial Revolution, the spinning jenny, the steam engine. You might have had to learn, if you learn the names of the men, if you go to the Industrial Museum in Paris, it's a different set of men, they're still men. But anyway, I'm not trying to rhyme you. But the reason for this, or to try to say, you know, why wasn't it France? I mean, the French complain about anything. Why wasn't it the French you've left us on? They were not as rich as us. We were the richest people on the planet 100 years ago. I first went to France at the age of 15. I could get 10 francs for a pound as a school child. 3 francs bought you a bottle of red wine. We were kings. Some of you, if you're older, will remember this. My granddad could remember going to France after the war and how he could have anything. When my granddad was born, he got $5 to the pound. When my mum was born, he got 4. When I was born, he got 3. When my oldest child was born, he got 2. The way things are going in the last 10 days, we are heading to 1. Bank shares. Barclays bank shares are now down 40% on what they were on the 23rd of June 2016. Very little reported. Lloyds bank shares are now less than half. In that 585-page document, there are 115 words, 2 lines on the finance industry. We're living in utterly remarkable times. If you didn't like the finance industry, this is the way to go. And I don't, you know, I'm a lefty academic, but it's a bit of a hard landing. It's a bit fast. The picture It's the last colony going, 1997. And I've put the picture up, maybe somebody will complain, given her father is the chancellor of my university, he might have a word with me at some point. But this is part of our myths. I don't know if you remember the pictures of her crying. And just as a side, we've got it in the book, is Prince Charles looking utterly gormless, not knowing what to do.
Hasn't changed.
Yes, indeed. Well, you've got to ask, if they took the Commonwealth seriously, they would have picked somebody from India to be the next head. The picture was portrayed as a picture of how sad it was that the last flag was dropping on the last colony and what great things we'd done. She cried for 3 hours that day. There's lots of films of her crying. She cried because she was having to leave Alex, because Alex was a very nice young man. And she said so in newspaper articles afterwards. But that was the picture of the last colony going, and that was the way it was portrayed, and it had nothing to do with the end of empires as far as that young woman was concerned. This was out of her control completely. She was having to leave the first serious boyfriend she had. That's the reality. I think we need to start talking about the reality of things rather than the myth. Immigration, which of course is connected to the empire. I could kind of see how another country you could get a bit annoyed. You know, if you were Norway and lots of people turn up that have nothing to do with your country because you've never invaded them, it might be a bit, you know, grating. But that's the rise that we've had since 1841. It's not that spectacular a rise. You see a very similar rise from other countries because people are moving further than they moved before. The biggest and most disruptive group of immigrants in this country, the ones who buy the houses so that you can't afford them, who don't learn the language, who are rude, who buy the Western Daily Mail, are the English in Wales. If you want to talk about disruption by immigrants, we can start with them. The most concentrated group of immigrants, the most concentrated group of children born overseas, in terms of the highest percentage of local children born overseas, are not Roma children in Sheffield. They're not even Pakistani or Yemeni children in Sheffield. They're not African-Caribbean children anywhere. They're the American-born children of bankers around Hyde Park. That is the most concentrated actual set of children born in another country. But we don't talk about it like that. I won't say much more about this graph other than it's remarkable that we don't produce graphs like this. The United States, they celebrate the immigrant origins of their country. We don't celebrate the immigrant origins. We create a fake history. The fake history is the Anglo-Saxon history. We were not particularly Anglo-Saxon. I've recently returned to the city I grew up in. When I was a seven-year-old child, like all seven-year-old children in Oxfordshire, I was required to make an Anglo-Saxon house. And you made your Anglo-Saxon house with lollipop sticks and fake straw on the top. And then, if your parents were clever, they kept it. So when the next kid was required next year to make it. Well, imagine my surprise, I'm 50 years old, and two of my children go to a primary school in Oxford. It's Easter, it's time for the Anglo-Saxon house. Because you've got to understand that you're Anglo-Saxon. I won't go on. This map's more interesting. This is a map from 2014. It's stretched. So it's Europe, the areas of proportion of the population. And what it's showing you is the proportion of immigrants everywhere. The dark blue areas, about 20% of people are immigrants, born in another country. The light yellow areas, it's less than 5%. We are currently in a less than 5% area. I was at a local school today, and we managed to hit 2% of the children were born outside of the country. So let's just test. Here, if you were born outside of the UK, could you put your hand up? We promise to be nice to you. 1, 2, 3, 4, more than 100. So yeah, we're less than 5% in the room. And, you know, the kind of people who come to talks like this are not representative of the local areas. I'm not going to do a poll of how you voted, but I absolutely bet you didn't vote like most people in this area voted. But still, you know, just 4%. And if you're thinking, oh, but there are loads of immigrants in Western, don't you know? The problem is you've been taught to look at people and think that there's lots of them like that. It's remarkably hard people don't sneak in huge numbers. They're not hiding anywhere. I've spent a long time in leave areas of Britain counting people on the streets, trying to guess. The most white, boring areas of Britain are the most leave areas. So let's just go through the map. In the UK, it is Northern Ireland. And that's mainly because a lot of people are born in the Republic and come up to the North, but also quite a lot of people came into Northern Ireland. And then it's London, and in particular West Inner London. Outside of London and the South East, most of England is like most of Eastern Europe. And it looks like a lot of Eastern Europe. And it's low immigration. And the correlation is absolutely opposite. It's about 0.79 if you're interested in correlations. The second best predictor of the Leave vote was how few immigrants do you have of everything. And it's easy to get scared of immigrants. I mean, it really is. And I do, hopefully we get to talk about this later, so I won't go on about it. The last thing I'll say, you know, I grew up in this little Midlands town. It's a little Midlands town in which almost nobody who's born there can live there anymore. In which, if I do a public talk ever in it, there's only been one case where Joel was actually chairing it. One case I did a talk in the city I grew up in, where I asked people, are you born in the county? And the majority of them put their hands up and said they were. And that case was, it was largely men who had learning difficulties and got benefits and were allowed to stay because of that. Normally just two or three people in my home city were born in the county. You cannot buy a house in Oxford, you cannot rent one. The house prices are 17 times average wages. The rent for a room is £600. You know, if you want to get really, really annoyed about immigrants, I can talk to you about what it feels to watch your hometown utterly destroyed by immigration. But it isn't the end of the world. Immigration is largely internal, but not all. That's Oxford. It's not Middlesbrough. It's not Stoke. You can rent a house in Stoke, honestly, for very, very little. It's the difference. Just going around, you'll see that big cities like Paris, of course, higher proportions of immigrants. But the really interesting areas here, this is Madrid, and that's the Costa. And you can guess who they are. And the fun thing over the next few months is the ones who come back first will be the ones who are ill, because they won't be allowed to access the Spanish health service. But we've been getting the National Health Service just ready for them, because we planned so well. The ones who can stay will, you know, stay until they become ill. It is quite remarkable. A third of our midwives in London are EU but not UK citizens. A third in Oxford. About 6 weeks ago, six maternity units in Oxfordshire, five of them shut their doors with no warning. All the midwives were ordered to go to the central hospital. All home births were cancelled. Any woman going into labour, well, she wasn't told. If you were in Chipping Norton, this is where David Cameron lives. If you're in Chipping Norton, you had to check the Facebook page of the maternity centre to see whether it was open. And if it wasn't open, you had to drive yourself to the John Radcliffe Hospital. And what they didn't say is, do not go into labour at 6 o'clock in the morning, because it's a traffic jam. We had a baby delivered 4 weeks ago on the A34. This wouldn't matter, except we're the only country in Europe, the only country which has had rising infant mortality in the last 3 years. And the deaths have been around the time of birth, and the babies who die are born to English-born mothers. Because the immigrants are young, fit, healthy, and educated. Right? It's the children of English-born mothers who are dying in greater numbers. It would be a national scandal if it wasn't for Brexit, but everything kind of gets ignored with Brexit. When I was born, we had the best infant mortality rate in the world. We had the first baby incubators. That was 68. By 1990, our neonatal mortality rate was 7th in Europe. Not bad. 2015, 3 years ago, we were 19th in Europe. And that was before we saw the absolute rises. We are heading within a few years to have a worse infant mortality rate than Romania. And it isn't because of the immigrants. It's the immigrants who actually help deliver the babies safely. And we have no plan. Midwives from the mainland don't come to Oxford or London, or here to Weston to work, because of the wonderful weather, or because the actual pay means they can pay the rent. They come because it's interesting for a year. We've been getting ourselves by on the fact that people will come for a year to run entire hospitals, universities. And if you want the most ridiculous side of Brexit, I think there's 65 documents now. There's one document I doubt any of you have read, which is what to do if you're in charge of a civic nuclear facility. That's the best document. Because the University of Oxford is in charge of a few civic nuclear facilities. But the government says they are committed to match the European funding to the end of 2019. End of 2019. After which, in the last sentence of the very short document says, we suggest you seek professional advice. my assumption is professional advice is what is the right kind of concrete to buy? Not just how do you pay the redundancy bill. It's amazing where we're at. Utterly amazing. But this is what happens when things fall apart. This is what happened in Russia after 89. It's what happened in the Ottoman Empire. What's happened in colonies at various times, this is what it feels like when things fall apart. We do it in a very civilized way. It might be an absolute blessing. You know, we queue. One of the tritest things I'll show you in a moment is, along with Hungary, we're currently the fattest nation in Europe. There's a little bit more about fatness. I feel like I'm qualified to talk about fatness, so I can do it. My one positive gesture, supposing we did crash out with a hard Brexit somehow, which looks less likely as of yesterday, and the 10,000 lorries bringing food a day didn't turn up. My suggestion, of course, is you have rationing, but we have a new particular kind of rationing, because I just can't diet. And the new kind of rationing is that those of you who are thinner, you're going to get the normal number of calories, but people like me should get a bit less. And within a year, we could go from the fattest country in Europe to the thinnest. Anyway, that's... Sorry.
So you're taking it all too seriously now.
Don't you think your MPs are going to sort it all out? You know?
Some of us remember rationing.
You do, yeah. We know it doesn't go back. Anyway, there's the immigration map. You know, if you think we were flooded by immigrants in 2014, either that data is wrong, or we weren't. The big country in the middle is Switzerland. If you want somewhere which has been had an influx of a huge number of immigrants, of which the largest numbers are German, French and English. English academics working in their universities without lights in Switzerland. What was the response over time? The little swirly graph is a new kind of graph, so I will try and explain it. The up and down on it is how much support there is for, in this case, UKIP, the BNP, anything to the right of the Conservatives, all added together. The x-axis is how fast is that support changing. And the key thing is, if we go right back to 1997 with the referendum party, and then do you remember getting a VHS video cassette from James Goldsmith in 1997? He sent them to every household in the country. James Goldsmith spent a huge amount of money and managed to get between 1% or 2% of the public to support his referendum party. But that was the kind of beginning. Then UKIP gets stronger. They get their support up at 2004, then it collapses. They get the support up again in 2009, then it drops down. Huge support up at 2014, falls away. When you poll people in Britain about their political beliefs about Europe or how they'll vote, in the run-up to a European election, they're very anti-European. The year after a European election, they're not. I think people have been manipulated. I think this is tabloids and so on. Because, you know, to say always when there's a European election coming, I really support UKIP, but not to say in between seems a bit odd. The pie charts are about well, I'm going to call them the far right, because I think we should do this, because it's more common. So let's create a definition of the far right. I'm going to define the far right as political parties who are to the right of normal European conservatives, by the EPP group in the conservatives, in the Europe, and the Angela Merkel's group, the biggest group in European Parliament. If you're to the right of that group, you are far right. They are right, you are far right. It's very spatial, very simple. Way back in the 1980s, the National Front got a 0.1% of the vote in European elections. We were 99.9% not a far right country. By the time we get up to around about 2009, UKIP and Co are getting 20-25% of the vote, but the Tories have actually left the EPP. They haven't joined anything else, so you're looking at about a third if you give some of their votes. But a crucial thing is 2014. And if you want to have a go at experts, I think it's fair because you can quote 2014, the 2014 European election. The proportion of people who voted in this country for parties to the right of normal European conservatives, which is DUP, UKIP, and the Tories, was 51.9%. I would say that at that point, this was a 51.9% far-right country. We talk about the Free Finns as being far-right, or people in Hungary as being far-right. If you look at the European Parliament, look at the MEPs who are the bedrock of far-right groups. It's Nigel Farage, it's Daniel Hannan. It's the bulk of our 73 MEPs. We are the core of the European far right. If you wonder why they're not that upset about us going, we don't think of ourselves like that. Nobody ever does. Everybody always thinks of themselves as normal. But this country, from 2014, supplied by far the largest number of MEPs who belong to the right of the European Conservative mainstream. And you could, in hindsight, in 2014, said you could see this coming. The graph to the other side, the bars are showing you the voting by age. It shows you what a high proportion of young people didn't vote in the referendum. The referendum was great because it taught young people to vote, so they voted in the general election next year. If you want to get young people to vote, that's the best way to do it. The key, the main age was 35 to 44. People are actually going to get out of bed and vote remain, that's what you need. But you can see that the old, of course it was the old who predominantly voted Leave. And they absolutely were not voting for selfish reasons. They weren't voting to lose the right to retire in the Costatel Sol. They were voting for their grandchildren, I think. They were worried they were voting for their grandchildren. The green line is the pound, the dollar. And I think there's a couple of things that's worth remembering. I'm going to stop in about 5 minutes, don't worry, it's a big question. The older you are, the richer and more powerful a country you grew up in. And something's gone wrong. But you've been told it's gone wrong because of the immigrants. Repeatedly for 30 years. Nobody's told you you're not so rich and powerful anymore because you're no longer the heart of an empire. We're now down to 10% for our manufacturing sector. It's absolutely tiny. But it collapsed because we were used to selling things to people who had final products. But the other thing that's really interesting is if you look at the school textbooks of each generation and what people were taught. And if you are in your 60s or 70s and you can remember your school textbooks, you were essentially taught you were superior. You were from a superior race in a superior country. And what's going wrong if you're from a superior race in a superior country? The most interesting views of all are from boys in public schools. Think Boris Johnson, think Dave, but think Reece Mogg, and so on. If you're trying to work out where the idea of Empire 2.0 comes from, or George Osborne. George Osborne in 2015 went to the House of Commons and claimed that if we followed his economic plan by 2030, we would be the richest large nation in the world. Why did he think we had to be the richest large nation in the world? Because he was brought up in an ethos that that was the rightful place for England to be. Because why had we been the richest place in the world? We'd been the richest place in the world because we were the fittest and most able of all races. This wasn't just public, well, he was a public school boy. William Beveridge, who went to rugby school, and was born in India. William Beveridge said that if you are middle class, it is your duty to have four children for the good of the race, the English race, and for the good of the world, because the English are better than everybody else. We know we're better because we built the railways and we owned a quarter of the planet. This may sound, and hopefully does sound weird to you, but some people really believe it. How do they come to believe it? The best guesses we can have is that which was the richest, most powerful country in the world when a strange man who liked beetles with a beard wrote a book called The Origin of Species and The Selection of Favoured Races, whatever is its subtitle, it was England. The English elite and the English upper class switched from believing that everything was decided by God to evolution at a time when they were top dogs. And we're still living through that. If you want to read one man, there's two books. Fintan O'Toole's book on Brexit is brilliant. He's Irish. All the good writing on Brexit is by people who are not white or are Irish at the moment. But Jacob Rees-Mogg's dad, his last book, explains Jacob Rees-Mogg. something else. And his last book, it's called something like Sovereign Wealth or something. He says England needs to be set free to trade financially in the rest of the world, no taxation, buccaneering spirit, and we will win. But we must be free of Europe because they'll start trying to control our bankers and so on. Here's the actual map. It's a map of which areas of the country will majority leave, majority remain. It's a fascinating map. I won't go on it because I promised to be quick. The map in the middle just shows you proportion of voters. And just a bit on the geography. More people voted leave in Essex than all 22 of those areas put together. Those 22 areas had a bigger electorate than Essex, but more people voted leave in Essex. Leave Central is Hampshire. I'm dedicating myself next year to pinning the blame on Hampshire. Nobody yet has. More people voted leave in Hampshire than the combined voters of Bolsover, Doncaster, Hull, Chesterfield, Salford, Stoke-on-Trent and Sunderland. Do you remember that image of that lass with two blokes in Sunderland, the blonde one? You know, two skinheads and a blonde girl on referendum night, and that was the message. They should have been down in Fleet in Hampshire, because that's what mattered. And those northern areas all voted leave, and they had a bigger electorate than Hampshire, but the turnout was lower. So Hampshire provided more Leave voters. I have what I'm terming the world's most boring lecture, which you're very lucky not to get, but hopefully I'm going to do in the World Geographical Society next year, where I go through every single one of the home counties and match it with parts of the north. And it takes about an hour and 20 minutes, and I'm determined by the time the audience leaves, they would have accepted that it is the south. Because that's the one thing we know. The only thing we know about voters is where they live. Kent. More people voted leave in Kent than Derby, Blackpool, Rotherham, Sheffield, fifth largest city in England, Great Yarmouth, Hartlepool, Merthyr Tydfil. All put together, as if you created an opposite Kent. All these stories about Merthyr Tydfil, you know, what are the Welsh doing? Don't they understand? The Welsh vote was the UK average. The Welsh voted Remain, Leave, and not voting spot on the UK average. And it's not hard to work that one out. But we want to talk about the ignorant Welsh. If you want to go into more detail about Wales, the areas where people speak Welsh are slightly more Remain, and they are balanced out by the areas where the English migrants from the West Midlands have settled. But Wales on average was average. This graph, I've got too many graphs, told you I've cut it down. This is probably the most insightful graph. It was produced by Daniel Watts, who I've never met, who is an unemployed researcher in Newcastle. And again, I think it shows experts are no good when unpredictable things happen. Experts are brilliant for general elections, because they tend to be like the last general election. You run your big model, you scratch your chin, you look like you know what you're doing. You make sure your hair's all very curly and unkempt, and you call yourself John Curtis. And you run the same regression model on the same polling station. Which, to be honest, you can spot them, you can get a measure of them 1% if you go to the same sample. But you look ever so clever, because you're talking about the same thing as last time. This vote was different. Daniel produced this. It's dividing the English constituencies into 10 groups, from the poorest tenth to the richest tenth, The richest 10% leave, sorry, anti-leave, the remain, absolutely core remain. Places where you go skiing twice a year. You really don't want to have a visa to get to the Alps. But the key thing about that graph isn't what happens in the richest areas, it's the fact that the poorest third of Britain was less leave than the middle. Middle England is leave central. That's our 4, 5, 6, and 7 constituencies. The correlation with deprivation was 0.03. That essentially is nothing. Right? The correlation with deprivation is 0.03, and I've cut out the graph by deprivation, but it wasn't poorer areas. There's no correlation with deprivation. Poor parts of London voted Remain. Rich parts of the South Coast, rich parts of Dorset, some of the richest parts of England, voted Leave. I promised you the bigger correlation in immigration. Immigration is 0.79. The strongest correlation with voting Leave by area is obesity, 0.8. Now, the academic who discovered that 3 weeks after the vote and published it on the NSE blog was absolutely taken apart by the Daily Express in the mail. So, and in a way, it was sort of slightly fair he was, because what he said was, there is evidence that people who are fatter are more feckless and don't think carefully. Now, I deliberately keep this weight on, so I can tell you deeply about what fat people think and how they behave and so on. But why do we get a correlation of 0.8 with obesity? I am sure, well, we could partly show this, but the single strongest reason is immigration. Right? Remember, immigrants are young, well-educated, annoyingly fit and thin, on average. Remember, the whole of Europe, apart from Hungary, is thinner than us. So the average European coming over is going to be thinner, but they don't say the average, they say the really thin ones. Right? Believe me, I live in Oxford and London. So that's part of it, but there's a secondary effect, which is if you live somewhere where everybody's thin, you eat one less cake because you feel fatter. I once spent a week in Kyoto, and I was the fattest man in Kyoto. But when I spent a week in the US, I'm happy. I've got the body of a god. Anyway, I won't go on about it. I think it's fascinating. It is not feckless fat folk. It is the geography of weight, which is affected by who's around you and what you do. I won't say any more about Dominic Cummings or about Boris. I think they're absolutely fascinating, the men involved in this and the men who wanted it. Standard & Poor's produced this graph a few weeks before the vote. They were absolutely annoyingly spot on, because I don't tend to like accountants, but they were. This is which other countries would be most affected by the UK voting to leave. And number one was Ireland. So they got that right. Number two is Malta. Lots of British in Malta. Then Luxembourg, banking connections. Then Cyprus, again British. Then Switzerland. And the really important thing about that is that in those most affected countries, and apart from Ireland, they're not that affected. In fact, Ireland's doing bloody well out of Brexit. You go to Dublin and just watch the cranes. The only part of the EU where you can speak English in shops. Get on, it's an incredible boost for Ireland. The key thing about that is that their countries don't matter. So when you're doing a negotiation for months and months over the summer in Brussels, and you're saying, oh, you've got to give us this because you're going to suffer, they knew before the vote they weren't going to suffer, because we are not an important country as far as France and Germany and Italy and Spain and the vast majority of the EU are concerned. I had a political journalist come over from the Netherlands a month ago, we were talking at lunch to other people about Article 50, and she turned around to me and said, what's Article 50? She's a political journalist, she writes political stories every day. We're not that important. It's really sort of sad and shocking to realise. We're kind of interesting, we're a double T, but we're not that important. Repercussions. I think that the June 2017 election was partly a repercussion. The June 2017 election is quite remarkable. Here's one of these swirly graphs again. The reason for showing you the swirly graph, that's Labour support. Labour support sitting around about 30%. Corbyn wins, not supposed to win, didn't want to stand. They all get very upset. They have another leadership election, he goes and bloody wins it again. They get really, really upset. Popularity skedaddles down to around about 26%. May's advisers tell her you absolutely have to call the general election. Nobody in this position hasn't done that ever. And they're completely correct. Nobody in that position of strength has ever lost seats. And then the absolutely impossible happens. And the absolutely impossible is this thing, which is swinging out at 6% point moves a month. I've drawn 2,000 of these graphs. This is the only one in which you get that. Every poll we've ever had for any parties in Britain since we started measuring. Never happened before. And so she loses control of the House of Commons and has to make a deal with a set of people who don't believe in evolution. Quite remarkable. The swings are the standard two-party swing at elections. That's the 1945 landslide, 10.4%, Labour win. Going right forward, that's poor old Michael Foot. Tony Blair, 8.8, looks very good, but that's after 18 years of Conservative rule. Tony Blair, without 18 years of Conservative rule, loses 2.5%. Tony Blair again, with an Iraq war, loses 5.5%. Gordon Brown, with an almighty economic crash, manages to lose another 6.2% on that. Ed Miliband, absolutely brilliant, stunning. Ed should be given some kind of super prize. Right, 1.4% swing was unbelievably good. The only problem is you need another 10 elections like that to get power, but it was really, really good. And then, the weird bloke with a beard who doesn't know how to speak and has an allotment and is hated by everybody, gets 9.6% in 2 years without a Second World War. Okay, so it really is remarkable. And partly it was young people voting for the first time, it was non-voters voting. And the really interesting thing is, after all these other big landslides, Labour does a bit badly because it gained power. And whenever you gain power, you're a bit of a disappointment. You don't actually deliver what you say you're going to deliver. The great thing for Labour this time is they haven't gained power. So they've got that swing and that step up. And there is no disappointment. We can talk about it in a minute about what they've done. But it's a lot less disappointing about actually having a cabinet not doing what the manifesto says they will do. There are millions of young people out there who've never voted. They can all vote. There are huge numbers of largely poorer people who haven't voted for years who could vote. And you've got 40% of the electorate who regularly vote Conservative who are about to discover what's going to happen to their house price. My favourite election fact is the 1993 local elections, I think, in London, where all the outer London boroughs, the Conservatives lost almost all of them because the house prices had fallen. Conservative voters won't bother walking to the poll if their house price falls. It's very trite, but it's one of the strongest things to see. Why are we putting up with it all? And again, only one more slide after this, so please think of questions. Why, when we've got falling life expectancy, it's been falling since 2014, we've got more dead babies, I mean, what more do you want? Real wage drops, food banks, 440 homeless people dying on the streets in the last year, 10 times the rate 5 years ago. Kind of thing, what do you have to do to get people out of the streets? And the answer probably is a hell of a lot in England. The next country to us in terms of protesting is Germany. 30% of German adults have actually been on a protest. For us it's just 15%. We take it. And that again may be empire. We are taught, brought up to be well behaved. Don't want to be seen on a march. That would be bad. You know, whereas the French will get out on anything. Yeah. Quite incredible. The French not only have broken the trend after Trump and after Brexit, they didn't vote for Le Pen. They all got together and voted for something they hate. Now they're protesting about it. But they protest. I mean, and we're not protesting. But in a kind of very English way, we're getting quietly very, very disappointed. here's the kind of last slide, the point of the last slide, I'll say nothing about the last slide. I think just showing the last slide and thinking about it, and try and think 10 years ago, just this simple image and the reaction to it, and what people think, I think, explains what is happening now, partly. And there's a shift in the sentiment. People are very, very annoyed. They don't want to put up with this. They want some kind of certainty. We don't know what we're going to get. Brexit's fascinating. It's told us a huge amount about ourselves that we didn't know. It opens up all kinds of possibilities. I think 52-48 is the perfect result. I think it would be the other way. 52% remain. We'd be having a second referendum now. This has called the bluff of the Brexiteers. It's exposed the illegal funding, which we'd never have known about if they hadn't won. They didn't mean to win. If you look at Boris Johnson and Michael Gove's face the day after, they really, really didn't mean. They weren't ready to win. They had no plan. But suddenly everything is up in the air, including the future of the Conservative Party. No political party lasts forever. Can we get two Conservative parties? Can any of you think of a name for Jacob Rees Mogg Party? I go for Christian Patriots, I think. Anyway, last image. And I'm going to stop there and leave it up. If you want one positive thing to end on, the nearest thing to this is the Suez Crisis. Some of you were here for the Suez Crisis, I wasn't. I'm going to calculate how this compares to the Suez Crisis. I think it's 6 to 10 times bigger. The way you calculate it is you look at the fall in the pound from the beginning of the Suez Crisis to the end, and you compare it to the fall in the pound over Brexit, and then we can say how many times bigger than Suez this was. Suez was an awful embarrassment at the time, but it changed things. It changed the class system of Britain, it changed the structure it claims, it changed who we thought was good and who we believed in. It meant we could have Lady Chatterley's Lover published as a book, and it meant we got the 1960s. And I don't think it's fanciful to think that out of Brexit, particularly a young generation is going to emerge who will not trust older people. And that's what happened after the Second World War. After the Second World War, a young generation came back from fighting, and they didn't trust a group of older people who had not just sent the country to one world war, but sent them to a second one. And everything changed in 1945. I think we could be seeing that again over the next few years. I don't know where we're going to be by March 29th. I can guess, but my guess probably isn't any better than yours. Thank you very much.
Okay, how are we
going to
do this?
Any
questions?
Yeah. Do you want to take the mic?
Which way am I going? Here we
go. Yeah, thanks, Danny, for that. That was absolutely brilliant. I'm querying, though. You talked about the correlation between deprivation and the Brexit vote and the sort of lies about the North versus the South. But we're in the West. How would you place Cornwall in that context? Because you've got an area there which is probably one of the poorest areas in the country, yet still delivered a disappointing result.
You're going to have to come to my most boring lecture. I've got 4 minutes on Cornwall. I've actually only just done Cornwall, and we're currently working our way through Gloucestershire. Cornwall, it has a lot of poverty in it, but also some incredible wealth. It's where rich Londoners retire and buy them, and where they have their second homes. And the remarkable thing about Cornwall was that it voted so strongly leave. And the people who voted leave weren't the poor. The poor didn't vote. The poor in the kind of, it's the inside of Cornwall now, because the poor can't be on the coast anymore. The poor don't turn out to vote, even for a referendum. Remember, 30% of people didn't vote. In the first election in their life, when your vote might have mattered, because general elections, most of our votes don't matter. Don't want to break it to you, it's like Santa. But 9 out of 10 constituencies, your vote is not going to make a difference at all. But this vote did matter. But in Cornwall, the bulk of the Leave voters were wearing pearls. And that's a remarkable thing. disgruntled, fairly well off, but not the rich affluent of North Oxford, not North London. They're the real winners. The real winners are very, very, very much Remain. The BBC, the Archbishop, all the parties, the DUC. The group who were most leave were people who were doing okay. They owned a house. They behaved all their life. They voted Conservative all their life. They sent their children to university. They had a child with a degree who was having to rent at twice a mortgage. And they have grandchildren who they can't see a future for. And that's the key group in places like Cornwall. This lady in the back.
You said that, you know, in your opinion, people in this country don't actually kind of protest. But my experience in the 60s, 70s, 80s, that people did do a lot of marching and protesting. And my day is what happened, that actually Margaret Thatcher brought in the thing about the individual, no such thing as society. And actually the European Union is all about sort of, you know, banding together to actually prevent another war happening. And actually what we've been promoting in this country is the complete opposite to that. You know, it's everyone for themselves. So that's going to be against the European project to start with.
Yeah.
And I've been very frustrated about people not being on the street. I do think it goes back to the 80s.
Yeah, I think you've got a point. Better run back with the mic. Thank you. We have had this incredible change. So other than Sweden, we were the second most equal country in Europe in 1974. You could have made a really strong case for not joining the European community in the 70s. You could actually have said, look, we're doing okay, and it is a rich capitalist club, they're more unequal than us. The irony is that it wasn't the EU that made us unequal, it was ourselves. Apologies if any of you were on the train from Reading today. But in the coach in Reading, what was remarkable, the woman opposite me looked at me with her eyes rolling as three different men decided to have really loud business conversations on their mobile phones because they were so important. And I was talking to her quietly about how this doesn't happen in Japan, it doesn't happen in Finland, and it doesn't actually happen in Germany. And the question about why do people behave in such a selfish way in Britain? And I don't think we used to be that selfish in the 60s and 70s. But it's been encouraged, the yuppies were encouraged, the idea of it's all about you, and you have a right to behave as rudely as you like for yourself. Because if you behave rudely for yourself, that will make everybody else richer in some magic way. And we've got to get out of that. I mean, that's the interesting point we are at, where, so over the change, 2005, 2006, the BBC routinely, about every 6 weeks, would run a story at the end of the news about bankers making a lot of money. And what I remember one story in particular where they'd signed a really big deal, and it was a BBC Good News Happy story, and they'd bought a giant magnum of champagne with a diamond in it. Now, a diamond was worth £10,000, but they'd actually just paid £30,000 for the champagne to celebrate their deal. And that was being put forward as good news. This year, I've got to come out of this because I forgot to say it, if you want a reason to be happy, the richest man in Britain, Martin Sorrell, was in effect sacked by WPP early this year. Then another man becomes the richest man, the boss of Persimmons. And the boss of Persimmons, a BBC reporter, and the BBC are hardly allies on this, I have to say. BBC reporter asked him about his salary. He walked off camera and menacingly said, I really don't think you should have said that, in the kind of way meaning it's going to hurt you, or it's a threat. Within a week, the shareholders have sacked him. So he sacked the richest person in Britain twice in 1 year. Average chief executive officer's pay, CEOs, went down by £1 million, 2015-16. The Archbishop of Canterbury, who used to be a very well-off banker, is on the record saying that his friends, top bankers, used to get £10 million a year, and now getting £5 million. But they're not complaining, that's a brilliant thing. I know they shouldn't, but the great thing is they're not complaining about going from £10 to £5 million. And this happened before, in the 20s and 30s in Britain. The same thing happened before. And once it begins, there isn't a way of stopping it. Because what kept the inequality up was the idea that somebody who earns £10 million a year is a wealth creator, and their existence is great for all of us. And once that myth goes, you know, it just takes a long time. That's the depressing thing. You know, we are looking at 20 years.
Thank you. You choose.
Thank you. You said that Jeremy Corbyn did work very well with the vote of young people. But have I not read at least a couple of articles this year which said that is not true? We looked at the figures again and everybody said that was right, and, but it didn't. So are you debunking the debunkers again?
I think I read one of those articles. They said it wasn't as strong as was originally said, but he was still much more popular amongst young people than Ed Miliband had been or than Blair or Brown had been. It just wasn't quite as big. There was enormous Jeremy Corbyn hatred. It's quite, and a little bit it's justified because he is so brittle and unmoving and unflexible and uncharismatic. But it is stunning how bad the reporting and press on that one man is. The key thing is he got a swing, almost as large as the 45 swing, in just 2 years, without the effects of a war. He partly got it because the rest of the Labour Party hated it. They wanted him to do really, really badly. If you remember, they're doing MPs doing votes of no confidence. And partly because they wanted him to do really badly. And this is the irony. Tom, the deputy leader, who was one of three people supposed to be doing the manifesto, Tom couldn't be bothered. None of the other MPs waded in on the manifesto. So a young lad called Andrew Fisher got to write a manifesto entirely on his own about what he might want for Christmas. And then it was leaked, accidentally, I don't think it was deliberate, the week before, even before, you know, Corbyn could have actually taken the sort of most radical things off it. And the British people were presented an unadulterated manifesto for the first time. Now, May, of course, was awful. She was truly awful. I mean, if you think Jeremy can't speak to an audience, you know, it's not her fault, but she really can't do it and she can't dance. The last thing to say on that is that the entire argument is between the Tories want to suspend 36% of GDP on public services, the radical Corbyn manifesto is 38. This still doesn't get us to Spain. Every other European country apart from Ireland spent more. So we're having an argument about 2% of GDP in a country that could be about to lose 8% of GDP, depending on what happens.
Following on from GDP, as you just mentioned, I'm trying to remain as optimistic as possible. So imagining that we leave and GDP does drop by 5 to 10%, can you see a way that policies can be put in place that mean not only inequality is decreased, but the poorest in society are not harmed?
Yeah. It's a good question in a way to sort of try that. That is theoretically very, very, very easy. It's very easy because you only need a tiny amount of money to make things better for the poor. But you've got to work out what you're not going to spend on anymore. I mean, I think we are going to be poorer as a country. I don't think we can afford an aircraft carrier anymore. We need to find somebody to buy it, the Queen Elizabeth. There's a number of things that we do that we're going to have to stop doing, which most European countries already choose not to do. We're going to have to tax the wealthy and the very wealthy, but they can't move their houses out of London. And all those brilliant Chinese who've invested, it's great. You know, so we're going to have to bring in, I mean, if you want the simplest one, you just take the council tax bans up to Z, and they have to pay them, and the prices go down. We are going to have to find money. There's absolutely no need for the bottom half of society to be worse off. They can be slightly better off, and the whole country become 10% poorer. And on top of that, if you want to get utopian about it, you know, currently 7% of our kids go to private schools. As the country becomes poorer, and this happened in 2008, that could drop from 7 to 5. So one in 50 children will have to mix with children who live on their local streets and won't be growing up with the stigma of having to pretend they didn't go to a private school. You know, this is normal European. I think a lot of ways in which we spend money sending a child to Ethan or Harold Modi and spending £35,000 a year on them leaves them with the impression that either they've wasted that money, for the further kids who don't get into Oxford and Cambridge, they've already failed from those schools, or they're so special that it made sense for their parents to spend 6 to 7 times more than the average child because they have within them the special genes and potential to rule. The fact that we'll be able to do less of that in the future, I don't think is a bad thing. If you look at the plans that Labour are making, I'm not a member of Labour, I like the Greens as well, but they're making plans. The SNP, I think, are very good in Scotland. I'd like to see them working together. They have plans for one different Act of Parliament every day for 100 days. That's how you do it, very, very fast. And at the very beginning, you put an Act of Parliament to compulsory purchase empty buildings in the cities, and you say that nobody will be sleeping on the streets who doesn't wish to within 100 days of an election. The day after the election, nobody pays university fees or loans. That's a manifesto commitment. No university is planning for that. They all think it can't happen, except, I'll give you one that they are planning for. John Healey, the Blairite housing, Shadow Housing Minister, has said it's now Labour policy to purchase land on the edges of cities where there's housing need at agricultural price, which is almost nothing. The three richest colleges in Oxford, for the first time in one case 800 years, are selling their land on the edge of Oxford now to private developers because of the risk of a Labour victory. In the circumstances of Brexit and an economic crash and a run on the pound, what you can politically do in those circumstances is dramatic compared to what you can do in business as usual. And it's very, very dangerous. The chance of getting it right is low, but you could rapidly improve the lives of most people. And a large part of the improvement is psychological. So when Labour won in 45, the bulk of the drop in mortality happened before 1948, before the health service actually began, partly because elderly people stopped killing themselves. The suicide rate of the elderly halved, because you killed yourself before because you were going to be a burden on your family. Even Tony Blair in 97 got a feel-good effect amongst, in terms of health, with things could only get better for 1 year. An idea that you've got a government actually cares about you and is doing things, and the future might actually be more stable than you think. So if you get expectations really low, like we've got no idea what's going to happen, but we could become a vassal state, or we could become Singapore the West, where only billionaires will be happy and most young women will work in service again. You know, we're actually getting the expectations really nice and low. So when you say we could be a decent normal European country in which your local school is good but not excellent, that's good, in which your housing quality is decent, in which you can't be evicted, in which they can't put the rent up because you have a Rent Regulation Act, the health service will actually work when you turn up at accident emergency, you won't have to work, wait 4 or 5 hours. You know, it's not asking very much, and that's all possible in a country that becomes poorer.
How many more?
3 more?
Right, so really, a few things really quickly. So number one, it's really interesting, although I'm not an advocate of the authoritarianism of it, but what happened to Cuba when the Soviet Union collapsed was that the Cuban economy collapsed 50%. So that's absolute devastation, basically its only source of credit and its only source of buying its products. It's a pig of the right. What happened was the Cuban government moved to do exactly what Danny said, was to protect the ration of those who needed it the most. So it was austerity reversed, as it were. They ended up, because they didn't have the oil to move their goods around, and off the farmland, and they also didn't have the pesticides and fertilizers to grow, they ended up becoming Havana today leads the world in urban agriculture. So it just reminded me of a Japanese speaker, the word in Japanese for crisis is made of two characters. The first one is danger, the second one is opportunity. And the only one thing though is we need to understand the nature of the crisis. And I think when we speak about inequality, how powerful, however powerful those work is, we need to recognise that it's a power relation. We need to name the reason it's capitalism, because Brexit is a titanic fiddling around with the deck chairs, but the ship is called HMS Capitalism. And however important it is to look at the nation state again, as Dan's doing, we also need to recognise that I agree with some of what the European Union, this is why I did not vote Remain, and I did not even vote Leave, and I like them. Do with it. Although my wife is making me, if there is a referendum to vote, as an energy consultant, I will vote for the fine. But the point is that it was the European Union, deeply undemocratic organisation, that the public really people through hell. So the neoliberalism here is neoliberalism. So we need to understand globally. Finally, one of the greatest books I've read is in the Jason Moore, Capitalism in the Web of Life. He identifies four chips that have kept this thing going globally for centuries. Cheap energy, cheap food, cheap labour, and cheap raw materials, all of those are peak exhaustion. So I'm extremely optimistic, but we need to name that beast and then get on with making the new utopia. But I think that's important.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
What do you think?
I'll do really quickly. I definitely don't agree with you over what's happening. It's that the most equal countries on the planet, like Finland, are within the EU. So I think the end of capitalism, in a way, along with Japan, we're beginning to see it.
But those countries would have also become much more unequal. Even Sweden is much more unequal. So the trend is the same.
Yeah. Crashes. Japan house prices halved, 89.90. My favourite is Amsterdam, which was the richest place before us, the United Provinces before England. House prices peaked, I forget the year, but in real terms they fell for 250 years. And I always tell this to people at the top of the market in London. I know somebody who has a hedge very rich, who bought one house and was trying to sell the other house, and they could hold two houses at once, it wasn't a problem. They're trying to sell their other house for 1.7 million, but they'd happily take 1 million at the moment. They had a deal last week. The deal broke through on the final day because Mark Carney said it's going to reduce by 30. So they're stuck with a... No, you don't feel bad about people who've got lots and lots of money. But the people with lots of money are already there. The market in the centre of London is definitely down 10, 15%. For the first time in my life, house prices are falling in Oxford. And the estate agent windows, for the first time in my life, have 10 or 15% off. And the question is, what happens January, February, March? You know, what happens when everybody's been told not? And I know we shouldn't worry about the rich, but you know, if you're interested in the end of capitalism, loss of sentiment and faith in the market is partly what's being engineered at the moment. There's two more questions, because I know my bladder's getting old as well.
In the 70s, I was a trading official, being a trading official most of my life until I retired. And obviously, the 70s, as you marked earlier, were the most equal period. We spent a lot of time campaigning to get part-time workers and to improve their employment rights and their pay, campaigning for the national minimum wage and those sorts of things. And obviously, trade union membership was at its highest. Obviously, we know a lot about Thatcher and other attacks on the trade union movement. And I wonder about the extent to which there is a correlation between trade union membership being high in the 70s and trade union membership being relatively low now, particularly in the private sector.
Yeah. There is, and trade union membership is higher in the more equal countries where it makes sense. Although, my union, there's nothing like them threatening to take your pensions away to suddenly see a doubling in union membership in a short amount of time. It's relatively cheap. And what people don't often realise is if you're a member of the union and they go for you, because we run out of money, because we're trying to find a concrete to pour in our nuclear reactor, the members of the unions are not going to be the first people to lose their jobs. It's selfishness, but I think just explaining that to people would help. go trade union membership up. But it was tricky because trade union membership worked in big organisations where you're all together. It was great for a car factory. It doesn't work if you're a cyclist delivering Deliveroo packages, although even they've won on something. And everything about positive. We do have the largest political party in the whole of Europe, and the only successful. It's a social democratic boring party. We think it's far left Labour. In European terms, this is a social democratic party with the largest mass movement of any party in the whole continent. You know, that's not bad. The question is how you make that kind of thing bigger and not just about MPs, because there's no point half a million people just trying to get 340 MPs elected. There's a lot more they can do. I'm kind of looking forward to some of that.
And last one.
Hello, everybody. You say we're at where we're at and there's a lot of uncertainty around, but it's not come up, actually. So what's happening at the moment in the media and certainly in the Labour Party is this discussion around whether we honour the result of the referendum or whether we go for a people's vote. So I'm just wondering what your views on those options are.
Or whether we have a TV debate on the same channel. My wife is for a people's vote avidly, and she and my daughter were there on the march. My worry is that it'll be seen as fake, whatever happens. If you put three options, hard Brexit, Theresa's 585 pages will remain. Remain will win, but it will not be accepted. But I don't mind it. I'm not campaigning for it. What I think could happen, and might have to happen, because we can't actually afford to leave, is that at some point before the 29th of March, whoever's the Prime Minister will walk out the back door down the street and round to the post box, which is there, and put the letter in the post box. And I've known for 2 years legally this is possible. The Prime Minister, and only the Prime Minister, not the Cabinet, nobody else will give up permission. The Prime Minister can at any point, up till 10 o'clock at night on the 29th of March, revoke Article 50. And I think there's a chance of that happening. You'll then get kind of very English Civil War, at which point you'll be very grateful that we don't riot, and so on. And the word traitor will be used a lot. And the sad thing is that our MEPs will still be there, but we'll get European elections in May if we revoke Article 50, so we'll get rid of them. We've got an almighty powerful finance sector. They are doomed under Theresa's agreement. I suspect, and I think what Labour would like to see is the Conservatives revoke Article 50, take all the blame, because this is a Tory Brexit. It's entirely theirs, it's their policy, it's in their manifesto. They're the party split. What I think Labour really need to do is to make sure people understand that this belongs to them. And I would keep on trotting out. The policy of the Labour Party is that nobody will be worse off, we will not harm this, and this, and we'll not do anything that does that. It's boring, and it crucifies you as a kind of individual. One great thing that Jeremy Corbyn is doing is kind of absorbing all the flack for when they finally elect the second deputy leader, who has to be a woman, which in effect is electing Jeremy's replacement. Whoever becomes the next Labour Party leader won't have any of that baggage of how terrible you were because you couldn't go for a man. And will also look incredibly eloquent and able, and will have an amazing honeymoon effect. That's what I think will happen. But, and I'm sure to raise this team, because they're all remainers around her, including her husband. I'm sure they thought about this. And the most convincing time to a vote on Article 50, the time when you can say we've tried everything, I've actually written a speech for her. And then the speech goes, I've got, you know, it's not just diabetes. I've only had 2 hours of sleep for the last 2 years, I'm dying, but I believe in everything else in my country above everything, and I'm willing to die for it. And for the good of my country, I have done this, and do with me what you will. And I've actually said in the Oxford magazine of my university that if she revokes it, we should take down the statue of Cecil Rhodes and replace it by one of Theresa May. And the fun thing about that is you get one set of Tories who love Cecil Rhodes arguing against another set of Tories. And there's nothing better than getting Conservatives arguing amongst themselves, because they're so good at not doing that. That's my money is on the actual revoking of Article 50 at some point. Not necessarily because we've seen sense, but partly the pressure of our enormous finance industry. Because you've got to ask, why are Barclays shares still actually at half their value? Why aren't they at 10%? And they're not at 10% because people who own shares in the banks think that they're going to get passporting. And the only way they can really have passporting is if Article 50 is revoked, because passporting is no longer being negotiated. The City of London is incredibly powerful. And I think enough people in the City of London would like to be in Europe under its regulation, rather than the UK becomes the second Cayman Islands. They're not panicking in Jersey and Guernsey, or the Isle of Man. If we really were going to leave, then what's the point of having the Isle of Man and Jersey and Guernsey? Because you don't need offshore tax havens if the UK is offshore. And I think if you look at all of that, you can get a sense that there are some people with a lot of money who think that the chance of hard Brexit is almost zero. And then it's either 585 pages, largely immigration control, or stay in. But the effects on the psyche of the country will be enormous. Mm. The feeling of shame, embarrassment. When the last thing I say, it's really worth watching the game that the mainland Europeans have been playing. The game they're playing in Europe is do not be the first country in Europe who explains realities of life to the British on air. So not a single of the EU27 leaders has actually gone on camera and said, do you know we can live without you? Not one of them. They've all done the, we're very, very sad you're leaving, we hope you don't, we really like the English. And they're playing a game. And the game is, who's the most competent politician who can avoid being the one who says, don't you know how stupid you look? And that, this is part of the embarrassment. And it's always embarrassing coming down from being number one. You know, I think that's the tricky thing. And I think partly, hopefully, maybe naively, hopefully, I think people on the mainland actually understand that the British have a particular problem that isn't necessarily our problem. And if any other European country had been the centre of the world's largest empire 100 years ago, they would be remarkably like us. If Germany had won the war, they'd be remarkably like us. But they're not. But we never lost a war. And that is part of our problem. Thank you very much.
Right, it just leaves me to say thank you very much for that, Danny. Excellent. I knew it would be a really enlightening talk, but I didn't realise it would be quite so entertaining. So really enjoyable, actually, although depressing in lots of places, but flickers of optimism amongst it, and really very interesting. I, for one, certainly learned a lot. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.